East Side, West Side, all around the town. Day or night, that's the life of a newspaper reporter. Ladies and gentlemen, meet Earl Sparling, a gentleman of the press, who offers a few of his true short stories of the lights and shadows of New York. Mr. Sparling.
Hello, you all. Now, this story of Ditto Dan, the capable cop, I got from Emmanuel Levine. Manny Levine has been a police reporter here in New York for 25 years, and I doubt if once during all that time he ever wrote a newspaper story. The men who cover police news don't have time to write their stories. New York is too big. Too many things are always happening. There are newspaper men here in New York who haven't been inside a newspaper office for years. They stay out on the job, out on the firing line. The news they get, they telephone in to be handled by rewrite men. Well, for half a lifetime, Manny has covered police news like that, just a voice over the telephone. But suddenly, a few months ago, Manny Levine became first-class news himself. For Manny had gotten plumb riled up and written himself a book. He wrote about the third degree and how police use it to make prisoners confess. A startling book filled with things you never read in your daily newspaper. Policemen are pretty brutal fellows, according to Manny. He cites examples of cruelty that would make a machine gun gangster feel pale, such as grinding down a man's molar teeth to make him talk. But Manny knows other stories about policemen that are more pleasant. And here is the story of the capable cop, as I got it from Manny Levine. Ditto Dan wanted a promotion, and he wanted that promotion bad. He was all fed up with being a small-time flatfoot. He wanted a big-time beat. He wanted a chance to hang his harness on the hook and wear a detective's two-pants suit. But the chances didn't look so good. If he had political pull, maybe he could get ahead. But political pull was something he had everything else but. If he were a big six-foot fellow and he went out and grabbed a dozen gunmen single-handed, that might count. But Ditto Dan was only 5'9", and the way he liked best to look at gunmen was laid out in the morgue after some other hero had punctured them. But the more Dan sat down and figured things out, the more he saw he'd just have to be heroic. A hero always got commended. So one morning, Dan dressed himself up in his oldest uniform and went down to the East River docks. It was a very pleasant morning, and on one of the pierheads, Dan bumped into just what he was looking for. On that pierhead, there was a dock rat, a stubbled bum in frayed trousers. The sun was shining on him, and East River was murmuring to him in his dreams. That river bum was sure sound asleep. Dan took one look, and he said, "Brother, you're elected." With one push, that bum was overboard and out in the river. And quick as a flash, Dan was jerking off his coat. "Take it easy," shouted Dan. "I'm coming." And he closed his eyes and dived. Now, Dan the copper wasn't much of a swimmer, just tolerable. And Pete the wharf rat had grown up on the river. About the time Pete the rat hit cold water, he came wide awake. He let out a whoop and started swimming. And the next thing he noticed was some fellow in a white shirt floundering alongside of him. This stranger seemed to be having a very hard time of it indeed, and Pete didn't like to see a man drown right before his eyes in a very wet river. So he paddled over to help. But what happened? He got up close and the stranger tried to grab him by the hair. Well, it looked like a toss-up which one was going to perform that rescue. They both made another grab, and Pete the wharf rat realized he had a tough customer on his hand. And Pete knew the only way to save a tough customer from drowning was to knock him cold and drag him in. So Pete hands Dan the copper a couple on the chin. Dan the copper doesn't like to have wharf rats busting him on the chin, so he pushes Pete one on the nose. That irritated Pete exceedingly, and he bangs the stranger several good ones over the right ear. Dan the capable copper is sort of waterlogged by now, and he goes into a clinch, and Pete drags him to shore without any more trouble. Dan is pretty much all in by the time the wharf rat gets him ashore. He lies there puffing and blowing, so the bum starts giving him first aid. Pete's idea of first aid was to lift a man up by his belt and then shove him down hard against the ground, and every time he does that, he wallops Dan over the back to knock the water out of him. And just about the time Dan has a little wind in his lungs, bang comes another wallop on the back. Right in the middle of all this, Pete looks along the dock and sees Dan's coat and cap, and he realizes for the first time that he has rescued a cop. That bum almost had heart failure at that point. It's dangerous business to slug a New York cop, even a drowning one. Pete stopped giving first aid long enough to think that over. And Dan the copper managed to get his first good breath of air, and Dan rolled onto his feet, stumbled down the dock. Pete was still thinking things over when Dan got back with his nightstick. "I had a hard time rescuing you," says Pete. "I had to slug you to keep you from drowning both of us." "Is that so?" says Dan. And down came his nightstick on that wharf rat's head. Pete took a seat very suddenly, and Dan the cop leaned over him. "Now listen, you blankety-blank bum," says Dan. "You didn't rescue me, I rescued you, see? And let me ever hear you telling any different kind of a story, I'll break your head and I'll send you up for life." Ditto Dan the capable copper got a medal and $100 in gold for that rescue. And just to show his heart was in the right place, he gave that bum 50 cents in cash. Well, here's another yarn. Across from the Chrysler Building, you'll find a little blind man selling newspapers. Above the windy rush of automobiles, you'll hear him asking in a mild, plaintive voice, "What do you read? What do you read?" And that's Charlie. And Charlie's still having trouble with that son of his. I stopped last night to buy a late paper from Charlie. And I asked him, "Charlie, how's that boy of yours coming along?" And Charlie got downright sad. "Oh," he said, "the kid's been fighting again." So I said, "Well, he won, I reckon, didn't he?" "Sure," says Charlie, "sure he won. There was a kid down in the next block, one of them tough ones." And Charlie got very downcast. "My boy always wins," he says mournfully. "He's a born fighter." Charlie was very mournful about it indeed. And wait till I tell you why. You'd be mournful, too. Charlie used to be a born fighter himself. You wouldn't believe it looking at him now. He's blind and heavy-footed and gray on the head. Also, he's just a little guy. He wouldn't come up to the average man's chin. Thousands pass him by every night. They wouldn't believe it if you told them. That half-pint of prize fighter? Baloney. That's what comes of being a bantamweight. In the cauliflower industry, it's only the Jack Dempseys and the Gene Tunneys that rate. You have to weigh as much as an elephant, and Charlie was never very much on a pair of scales. He fought at 115 pounds in the old days, and so he was just another mosquito, a little fellow who burned himself up in the Trillins. The fight mob don't remember the big fellows very long. They don't remember the little fellows at all. The little fellows are just appetizers. They fight the preliminaries, and while they fight, the fight fans blow stale cigar smoke toward the rafters and yell for the main event, the heavies who can really hit. So Charlie fought night after night like that all over town, year after year, while the mob cracked peanuts and yelled for the big show. Charlie knocked the daylight out of them, those little fellows who couldn't hit, and they knocked the daylight out of him. That wasn't fighting for anybody to get serious about. The little fellows can't hurt each other, you know. There's not a killer in a car road. Who remembers them now? Who remembers Charlie? Charlie fought 80 fights. And those little fellows, they hit so gently, they knocked them blind. But what I started out to tell you is about Charlie's boy, who was just 15. One day last year, the boy came to Charlie and said, "Dad, you got to learn how to fight." And Dad got worried right off. Dad rolled his blind eyes and said, "Nothing doing, kid. The less you know about fighting, the better." The boy said, "But you were a fighter, Dad. Why can't I be a fighter?" "That's just it, kid," says Charlie. "You learn how to fight and you'll end up a bantam pug like I did." "You keep away from fighting," says Charlie. "You're a little guy, and fighting never got a little guy nowheres." But one day the kid came home with blood on his nose. Dad couldn't see it, but he could smell it. He knew the smell of blood. It was a little fella, whimpered the kid. A head taller. "He picked on me, and I don't know how to fight." And that night, Charlie faced a crisis. He didn't want his boy to be a fighter. What would fighting get him? He'd end up blind selling newspapers in front of some tall building. But Charlie turned to the boy that night and he said, "Get your shirt off, kid. I won't teach you too much about fighting, but there ain't no big palooka gonna hand you anything." So you picture, Charlie, the little blind man squaring off in the dining room of his flat over on the east side. They pushed the table and the chairs against the wall. Not much space here, for the blind man don't want much space. No stale cigar smoke going up toward the roof. No cheap perfume from the dolls in the ringside seats. No flood of lights on a squared ring. Just a cheap dining room and a little blind man who learned the tricks of fighting in 80 fights. And Charlie taught that son of his how to 1-2 and step out of it. How to use his elbows in a clinch. How to throw his weight on the other guy's wind. How to follow through and cover up. And how to lean on a good stiff wallet. And that boy soaked up knowledge as a sponge soaks up water. Listen, after three lessons, he came home one night and said, "Dad, I bumped into that guy who was picking on me today. I didn't have no business being afraid of him. He's just a stumble bum." And listen, after a few more lessons, he came home one night and said, "Dad, I bumped into that big palooka again. He didn't want to fight, but I made him. He rushed me and I bicycled. I sidestepped and I led with my left and then I planted a right. I remembered everything you said. I went through straight with my elbow in and I swung my shoulder and followed with my leg. And just like you told me, I could feel that sock all through me, just like I was lifting him by the chin." Charlie looked sad. But the boy was too busy babbling to notice that. "I wanted to try that leg swing again," the boy babbled, "but they couldn't make that bum get up out of the gutter." Well, Charlie started trying to hedge on his job. He'd say, "No, I'm tired, kid. I taught you enough." But the boy'd say, "Oh, teach me a little more." And after all, Charlie was an old-time pug, and he loved fighting. Teaching that kid was like learning all over again himself. When he and the boy got into that dining room, the smell of fried onions faded away, and Charlie could smell rosin again, and he could hear the forgotten mobs booing and shouting and yelling for blood. And Charlie is very sad about it all now. "I guess I taught him too much," he says as he folds your paper. "You know, blood tells. That kid takes after me. He's a born fighter. It worries me plenty. That kid of mine will turn professional one of these days. And what'll that get him?" And Charlie frowns and rolls his sightless eyes. "Say," he grumbles, "I wish you could see that kid of mine fight. Goodbye, you all."
Thank you, Mr. Sparling. And so we close our book of true short stories of the lights and shadows of New York, brought to you by Earl Sparling, a gentleman of the press. This is Frank Kendall, returning you to your local announcer.